Well, I have a wonderful electronic invention I want you to see. It looks something like this.
What's going on, Curiosity Builders? I'm Chris Martin, and you're listening to Getting Work to Work, a weekly podcast for creative entrepreneurs, makers, artists, podcasters, writers, filmmakers, designers, and coders who are on a mission of bringing their ideas to life by creating new things and getting their work to work. Whether you're just starting out or have been at this creative life for some time, I hope you'll learn something new in this podcast, challenge your assumptions about what is possible, and chase big ideas so you can become who you were born to be. Are you in pursuit of ideas and work that you haven't experienced before? This form of curiosity for growth and impact is a theme that defines the work of both Peter Burr and Ivar Zaley. Peter is an artist and master of computer animation who blurs the defining edges between art, animation, and video games with everything he does. Ivar is an art curator, entrepreneur, and supporter of artists who is bringing contemporary art and visual expression into the public space through the annual Supernova Digital Animation Festival and his work with Plus Gallery and Denver Digirati. This interview episode of Getting Work to Work was recorded live on stage at the Bend Design Conference last week. Peter and Ivar touch on the importance of curiosity, touring as an alternate way to distribute work, the merging of animation and contemporary art, the impact of supporting artists, and so much more. Show notes and links to resources mentioned in this episode can be found at gwtw.co/347. You'll also find links to stream the show on the major podcast platforms and an opportunity to sign up for my email newsletter, The Curiosity Lab. Each week, I send out some thoughts on curiosity along with books, videos, podcasts, and other resources blowing my mind as well. I'm Chris Martin. I'm the host of Getting Work to Work, and I really appreciate you coming out to this live interview with Peter and Ivar. It's not normal for me to do a live version of this podcast. So normally when I do this, I send an email to someone with a link to an online recording environment. They're in their space. I'm in mine. I've done a lot of research, and we just start talking. And the process of talking is just to start capturing that attention that isn't there sometimes. And I've learned to kind of hear for that attention. And what's really interesting is I've kind of designed a conversation around this podcast that starts to hook people's interest because we get really distracted with technology. But what's fascinating is it only takes a few moments in a conversation where you can start hearing and start capturing those little things, the words said, the feelings expressed, and then away we go. So that's kind of the process that kind of goes into this. We're going to do this live interview. We're going to have a chance for questions from anyone that might have questions for Peter or Ivar or myself. This is really an open forum. I think podcasting is a great medium and everyone should do it. So normally what happens is I have a little pre-roll for the podcast and I'm going to do that later. And so I'm just going to pick it up like I normally would in a conversation with an interview. And usually the first thing I say is, Peter, Ivar, welcome to Getting Work to Work. It is an absolute pleasure to have you on the show.
Thanks for having us.
It's an absolute pleasure to be here.
Are we going to have any live mattress or underwear commercials?
Squarespace.
Okay, good. Just checking.
They are the official sponsor of every podcast on the internet, except mine. Right out of the gate, you know, what's one interesting thing people should know about you? And we'll start with you, Peter.
Oh, that's a hard thing to jump right out of the gate. I don't think I'm properly qualified to tell people what's interesting about me, but maybe we can figure it out through a conversation.
Oh, gosh, there's too many interesting things, but just a little known fact. I'm immersed in the arts, have been for most of my adult life, but I'm an avid tennis player, and Peter knows this, so
really?
That's the only thing I'm going to divulge. It's kind of interesting if you play tennis.
Who was the tennis star that just, when you saw them play, you were like, my gosh, I want to be like them?
Bjorn Borg.
Okay. I was thinking Andre Agassi with the mullet.
Nah.
and the pink Nike shorts.
Yeah, not so much. I'm more the classic long hair hippie look.
Okay. So one of the things that I find interesting about Peter is that yesterday when I was talking with him, he said, between the panel in the morning and your interview in the afternoon, I'm going to go bouldering, rock climbing. And how did that go? I'm completely fascinated with an artist who rock climbs.
One of the really incredible things about being an artist is being invited to come to things like this conference, like Bend Design. And it seemed unusual to travel all the way around the country and not partake in some of the things that are so... somebody yesterday told me that Bend is really good at PE and recess, but like math, English, but you know, that's just a different thing. So yeah, it was incredible to go take a walk on the Deschutes River and then go climb some stuff that hurts my hands and then come back and get back into my brain. It feels really healthy.
Yeah. And that's something too that, you've talked a lot about, is just when you're an artist, you've struggled in the past kind of with that mental health aspect of just the things that you go through. And I imagine when you're climbing rocks, you're able to maybe escape some of that.
Well, it's a couple, for me, it's a couple of different things. I mean, as a trained animator, I spend a lot of time in isolation. I think this is common for a lot of people that have a personal practice, and a lot of people that work on computers. It's while there are these social networks that we can tap into, we're actually just alone with these electronics. And so, you know, that does certain things on our bodies, and that does certain things to pervert our minds. There's a nice thing about getting dirty. Yeah. Today I was climbing with my friend. It was nice to just, at some point I was shooting a picture of him and I realized we're kind of these middle-aged men acting like 12-year-old boys, right? We're climbing, like, at one point we're just climbing inches off of the ground, but, you know, we're just like playing hot lava, and that feels really healthy and fun.
Yeah.
And it is, in a way, it's an antidote to all that time spent in my head digging, getting at what really is important to me in this more broad internal or ethereal sense. It feels nice to just get dirty and to be with friends.
Yeah. And Ivar, you were telling me that you were just, after your panel earlier today, you're like, I'm going to get some sun. So that kind of seems to be a recurring theme where, you know, getting that sun and the exercise and really refreshing and re-inspiring yourself.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think a lot of it had to do with going to the location for last night's event and Marty pulling me over to the river and going, wow, this is really beautiful. And who knows if I would have discovered it. You know, you're so busy with a forum like this that you kind of look at your schedule and say, I got to do this, got to do this, got to get back to the hotel, do some work. But taking a little time is nice. And today was easily the most beautiful day you could imagine.
Yeah. One of the things that fascinates me about the two of you is that you have a past. Like, you know each other from various moments throughout time. And what struck me when we were talking, Ivar, is that you said, Peter inspires you in, how did you word it? Unusual ways. How does Peter inspire you in unusual ways?
Well, yeah, I mean, his artwork is, you know, impressive, and as a human being, he's very impressive. And I think that a lot of times I like to draw things back to the start and like where something originated. And my origin story with Peter is back in 2006, 2007, I think he just reached out and said, I've got this project called Cartoon Express, and wanted to see, we're looking for a location to host. I didn't know anything about him. I can't even remember how you reached out, probably via email or something, but or even why he was reaching out to me. I was running an art gallery at the time, and the gallery had a reputation in Denver, Colorado, as one of the few places to host experimental performance or, you know, works that would take place in the evening and not have a commercial value. Peter inspired me initially by presenting this sort of out there idea that fit the framework of our experimental program, but also I think tapped into some sensibilities with me that relate to my film background. And when he showed up and the evening was done, it's something that will never leave my brain for as long as I live. And I said earlier at my lecture this morning that it was probably my favorite evening that I've ever hosted my gallery, you know, in 15 years. So yeah, you know, that's Peter's, I think the inspiration comes from daring to, you know, work with constructs that not everybody is doing. And he certainly impressed me by wanting to tour this around the country. A few years later, he was still reaching out saying, you know, we're taking it on the road again. was definitely looking for like a stipend for the project. I'm like, mm-hmm. as a commercial gallery, I can't make money on this, but you should be getting this into institutions and, you know, higher level spaces, which I think you did. And that really impressed me as well.
Yeah.
And ever since then, he's continued to impress me.
Yeah. That's really fascinating too, because as an artist, Peter, why are you reaching out to people? Don't you just get a manager or representative to do that work for you? Why do you go the route of being a curator for your own art?
I hear people do that. I just never, I mean, so I guess like in terms of what, when I created Cartoon Express, so this was 2004, 2005 was when I started that project. I started with a few friends when I was living in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and then moved to Portland, Oregon. And it really came out of a few different things. First of all, I went to art school. I graduated in 2002. And I vividly remember when I was graduating, my thesis project was this. It's an animation. I was using digital technology. I was combining things that I'd never seen done before. And that was part of what was exciting at the time about mm-hmm. making a project. I'd never seen anything like that. It mm-hmm. still is one of the main things that motivates me to make work today, is to try to make things I haven't seen before.
That's cool.
But at the end of the day, the form that I was making was a film. And so what do you do with that? And so I talked with one of my instructors, who's an animator, who had a long history of showing in film festivals, as to like what is a possible path for this. So 2002, internet then was different than it is now. He showed me a trade publication, a filmmaking journal, where in the back of it was just lists of different film festivals that you can apply to. And I remember going down and just seeing next to each film festival, and none of these I'd ever really heard of, but there was like $30, $20, $50. And I just did the math, and I was like, I just spent a bunch of money to go to art school, and I'm still being charged to be an artist. This just doesn't make sense.
No.
Around that time, when I was graduating, I didn't own a computer. I would use the computer facilities at school to make my work. So when I graduated, I didn't have access to that technology. Mm. So I started making comics, zines, because I was still, my interest in animation came from drawing and painting. And so in a way, making comics, it's very similar to making an animation. There's obviously massive differences, but you're still in this kind of durational aesthetic. You're still in this time-based form. Mm-hmm. And I, around this time, was exposed to a project called the Bookmobile Project, Projet Mobilive, which was a project that ran for about 5 years in the early 2000s, started by a group in Montreal and was kind of co-housed between Montreal and Philadelphia. And essentially, they took this model of, you know, it's in a lot of different towns, the traveling bookmobile. A lot of libraries have bookmobiles. But this was a project organized by artists, community activists, a group of radical people who were like, why don't we take the same model but apply that towards zines and independent publications? Realizing that with this format, with this material, with this medium, one of the major impingements of this medium is that it's like zines are made in really small runs. Oftentimes, at least at that time, people would frequently like steal copies from Kinko's. Maybe you'd pay for it if you had a lot of flush cash, but like it's a low run, and coming from really specific subcultures, and often the topics pertain specifically to the audiences that they were, right? They're very specific and very limited in that way. And so what would happen if you took a bookmobile and you traveled around North America with that, and with a specific intention to reach a remote and on hard to reach places to kind of distribute this. And so I joined that project and traveled with them. I was very lucky. I spoke French because I lived in France for a bit of time when I was in school, and they needed a tour guide to travel with them through Quebec. And so I joined the project. And after a couple of years working with that project, it made a lot of sense that this is an alternative model to distribute work. I mean, it's a lot of extra work, but it's a potential model. And so in 2004, the internet being a very different place, I just kind of applied that towards my interest in making experimental film, experimental animation. I was traveling a lot, so I was meeting a lot of different people that were making radical work, and I had no idea where to see this work, because internet video was really different back then. This was before YouTube.
A lot of buffering.
There's a lot of, so the technology wasn't there and the culture wasn't there.
Yeah.
Like, and a lot of different levels, the infrastructure wasn't there. And so at the time, it just kind of made sense. There was a void there, and there was a motivation because I didn't want my work to be another kind of valve outside of my financial health to be a drain. And so, yeah, so I applied my energy that way.
I'm interested, too, in something that you just said. You went to animation through drawing and painting. It made me think of David Lynch, who went to film through painting. And so why animation and not full on film? Was it cost, or was it, you know, was there something else driving that interest?
Well, yeah, I guess live action film compared to animation, they're different. Like the social dynamics are very different. Mm-hmm. I was compelled to start making animations because I liked spending a lot of time in my studio drawing. Mm-hmm. And so animation required me to spend even more time in my studio drawing, which is a very different process than putting a crew together and going out and shooting something. And to be honest, I'm not particularly stoked on storytelling. I think it's important. Mm-hmm. I think it's an interesting way to transmit information, and it's an interesting way to contain time, right? To, especially if you're presenting work in a movie theater, if I want anybody to consider spending 90 minutes with my work, like, a story is a great way to compel you to spend time with my work. But yeah, it was just a different thing, and it pushed me towards a different type of experimenting.
So Ivar, when you are moving to animation from art dealer and film, you were on Sundance, if I'm correct.
They worked for Sundance for about 10 years.
Yeah. So what led you to animation from film and art dealing?
Well, that's a really good question. And it's been a fantastic convergence. My film background was the first part of my career, and I was very immersed in it. Always felt like I was very well versed in it, much more than contemporary art. But I kind of reached a point within film that I felt I wasn't going much further than I wanted to. And the lure of contemporary art caught a hold of me, and I decided to open up an art gallery and see what happens. And, you know, what really happened is I never lost my interest in film. My understanding and passion for contemporary art grew. And then all of a sudden, the two just merged. Peter was one great example of looking at an artist who wants to bring this unique project where he's a curator, he's a performer. I think he played the guitar. he went by the name of Hooliganship, which, you know, also, like, there's stimulating factors to what artists do that are much different than filmmakers. Even though I was running a gallery, my interest in film was there. I used to do projects with the film purists that, you know, they never wanted to market anything, but they wanted to bring the most obscure things to a public setting, just so they could bask in watching it. And you go, there's something beautiful about that. But as I started seeing, you know, movements develop within all artistic mediums, it was the merger of animation with contemporary art that caught my interest the most. And I think Peter was a great introduction to that. Certainly not the introduction, but he brought it forward in a way to me that opened my eyes to some artists that I was not aware of, and just saying, yeah, there's something happening here, and it's tapping into my sensibilities as a contemporary art dealer and curator. And of course, in that role, the premise was always, there is no commercial way to operate with these type of artists. Right. You had to do it as a passion project and not as something to make money. So, you know, I was well aware of video art and very studied in video art, and saying, gosh, if I could present that in my gallery and find a market for it, that would be wonderful. But I knew that I couldn't. So it wasn't until my next level community project came along, and the artists that were using digital tools like Peter really just materialized and said, here's something that maybe has some potential that straddles both of my interests. And I also quickly learned that it's not going to straddle the interests. There has to be, like, you know, a new frame of reference for it.
So the change that you're mentioning, going from running Plus Gallery to Supernova, where you're going from one kind of art space, I'm assuming, to a larger public space with animation.
Yes.
Like, when you're experiencing, like, other artists and they're changing your conceptions of what is possible, what kind of metamorphosis are you going through internally to really realize, okay, I'm going to move away from this and go to this new opportunity.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, I never asked for the opportunity that materialized into Supernova. I gave a whole presentation about that earlier today, and it's like this thing that emerged out of the ether, and you go, I never imagined it developing into something. And I'm naturally kind of a curious person, and if confronted with something that inspires me or that I have the opportunity to develop, I usually take the ball and run with it. Being an art dealer is one of the toughest things a person can do. And trying to sell somebody's art is like, it's a mysterious process that I don't think most any human being understands. Artists don't get it. Even dealers, there used to be no literature on the ins and outs of that because nobody wants anybody to know the reality of it.
So I can't buy Art Dealers for Dummies?
There is a book on selling. Yeah, no, there's there. Yeah, that book is ridiculous. But you know, actually, there is some good material that's evolved in the last decade towards the subject. But making the switch was more of a timely factor in saying there are things evolving into the system of life that are causing issues for being an art dealer, representing artists at my core. I want to help artists. I don't want to be an artist. I don't want to be known for anything other than trying to support artists. And switching to a different level of artist through a project that doesn't have the financial attachment in the same way, it's been a bit of an adjustment and a shift. But what's really inspired me is looking at the artists and saying, it's not like I'm dealing with an entirely new set of art standards or ways of thinking about art. I tell most everybody that some of the best artists in the field of digital animation, like Peter, like Jeremy Couillard, like Katie Torn, like so many others, they have traditional art references and educations. And so many of them were illustrators or painters. And even today, I look at that work and I say, they're making a choice to put this into something that has the same origins as experimental film. Animation is an extension of experimental film. So it's a really valid and vibrant form of art. And there's no reason to look at that as its own separate entity that has a different layer of principles. But the artists are wonderful people. I found that maybe it's because of my film background. I think that you do have to be extremely intelligent and dedicated to make something that, you know, doesn't have an inherent value the day you produce it, or you think it, you know, could blow up. It could just pass along like most content does.
One of the things that you just said that was interesting is this idea of support and supporting artists. And so, Peter, from your perspective, what's it like to receive support for your art from someone like Ivar?
I mean, it's great. It's, well, I mean, for me, one of the interesting things in leaning into making work that, I mean, use the term work not having value, I would say work not having a coherent function, right? It's like, but arguably all artwork is serving some, maybe it's an emotional or spiritual function. It could be decorative. I don't make decorative work. But there's a way that, like, choosing to do that, it's a really bold proposition. Why would you do that? In a way, like, I had to find ways at the outset to liberate myself from a lot of really conventional trappings of what is normal, what makes me feel secure, what makes me feel stable, embracing poverty, right? And so in a way, like, immediately that sort of encoded a really different set of values that I had to discover and I had to lean into. And so when I think about this kind of support that Ivar is talking about, I mean, there's, to me, the most maybe valuable kind of support that's there is really this sort of emotional or community support, one that sort of validates a world that I'm interested in building. There's a way in which, like, one of the foundations of the way that I work is to be logical. And that's not like obviously. That's not like do things that are smart, but it's right. like to find a logic that works and to commit to it. And obviously course correct when you have to, but mm-hmm. that could be boiled down to like be nice to people and expect that back. And if they're not, fuck them, yeah. right? You don't have to support that world, right? Mm-hmm. You can build your own. And so expanding and extending this world with people like Ivar is really one of the most essential things. Of course, money is important, mm-hmm. right? Like that yeah. is, in a way, another token of support. That just gets a little trickier. Mm-hmm.
The whole idea of supporting, you know, people, particularly art dealers, there's like so few that want to just do something because they see the value in that art form. They're so mm-hmm. driven by money or the dedication to just finding work that sells. And I always like just felt counter to that. Like the best work is that which is not commercially viable, mm. but it's the most exciting. It's where I think it's the most genuine. So trying to elevate that and bring that about is essential to my being, but it is a tough road. And I think what a lot of people don't understand is the side of the host. And one of the premises that I've told people over the course of the years is, you know, somebody reaches out to me and says, hey, I do this avant-garde experimental thing and you have a gallery and I'd like to, would you host it? And I have to make a judgment call that says, well, I have a great space. I'm interested in this, but what's going to happen if nobody shows up? It feels kind of dumb, you know? Yeah. And that is a very strong sense that I had through years of doing this, where you go, maybe that intimacy of a 10-person audience is fine, but it can fluctuate between, you know, almost nobody showing up to needing some kind of established overlapping audience that you nurture, you grow, and you have to do that for the love of the support and what you get out of it. Hmm. And that's just something that I think a lot of people don't understand. Being in a private gallery context, we don't have the heft of a marketing platform that institutions have. For me, the challenge was saying, I'd really like my clients to enjoy hooliganship. None of my clients are going to show up to see something called hooliganship, even if I convince them that it is the greatest artist in the world. So that trade-off is, I don't care, fuck them, if you know, if they don't appreciate that I'm doing this. Over time, you build up maybe a trust relationship or just a different understanding with those that are seeing you for this value, and they understand that you have other interests as well that relate to the to art forms that you're passionate about.
So it sounds like you're not only curating art, but relationships. You're curating trust. You're curating an audience. You're curating a lot of different things that all then tend to support the art.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've always liked to look at things as a long-term relationship, and also saying I don't know what might happen by stepping into this territory. So Peter's the perfect example of that, and saying as much as I enjoyed the evening, and it was successful, we did have a nice audience, and I was kind of blown away by it, but I didn't start following Peter. The next time he materialized was in the Monkey Town context. And sitting on stage with him now and saying, our relationship is over a decade long. I think this is maybe the fourth time I've been in person with you. It feels like we know each other very well. And the communication, of course, happens on different levels. But to go back to the start and say, you would never see that long term unless you're the type of person that appreciates that careers aren't made overnight. Things develop over time. If you put yourself out there, you never know where it's going to evolve into. But it's very exciting for me to see that some of those relationships carry forward from the most abstract or experimental grounds that you could be involved in.
Yeah. I love the idea of things evolving over time. And yesterday, Peter, after Pattern Language, you shared that film in many ways was the result of, I think, a decade-long practice of your work. And so I'm curious as to the evolution of your process over time. You're by yourself. you're in a space and naturally you're experimenting and you're trying things. What does that process look like for you? Is it an intentional process? Is it a serendipitous process? Is it a throw things on the wall like Ralph Steadman, or on, you know, blow ink on a paper to see if Hunter S. Thompson likes it? I mean, you know, what is it?
Well, I mean, it's a lot of different things, and this conference is also part of that process, right? Mm. Like, I don't always have to be making to be in process, right? Like, yeah, research. Community, mm-hmm. Living a life. I mean, as an artist, one of the responsibilities that I place on myself is to make sure that my work feels like it's coming from a life that's lived, mm-hmm. hopefully well-lived. Maybe that doesn't even matter, as long as there's sort of a connection to being engaged in the world. And so this is part of that process. But I mean, in regards to pattern language, since everybody in this room saw it yesterday, mm-hmm. I mean, pattern language came explicitly from a video game project that I've been working on for a few years. And so there's a number of different systems, different levels of complexity that are things that I can rely on because I've put in thousands of hours developing these different systems, and I know how to work with them. I know how to use them. They're like tools that I've built. Mm-hmm. But like I was saying earlier, one of the things that inspires me to make new work is to try to make something I've never seen before. Mm-hmm. And yeah, that's an iterative process because I haven't seen it. Mm-hmm. What is that going to be? So for pattern language, I mean, I had the great fortune of being given a black box theater in Lower Manhattan for 2 months. And mm. so I hired a couple of people to help me install 4 giant screens in a semicircle with projectors with 7 speakers. I hooked up a mixing board, I hooked up computers. And so I built this multi-channel, multi-sensorial environment to work mm. in for 2 months. And I invited a sound designer who I'd been working with for many years. I really trusted him, and he's mm-hmm. great, John Also Bennett. And a programmer who's a really incredible artist as well, named Mark Fingerhut. You know, there were certain intentions. We were in Lower Manhattan, and so there's a reality to that space, to the alienation, to the modernism, mm-hmm. to the capitalism, to the dirt and the struggles, but then also the beauty that we're a part of. And so it's like, over the course of that 2 months, I want to make a piece that can kind of plug into this larger video game that I'm making. And I knew mm. I needed to start thinking about level design, right? Like, I want to make a video game. I've never done this before. Video games should have levels. Let's let this be an opportunity where I'll start to build the architecture of this space, which led me to discover this book, Pattern Language, which became the title of this artwork, which is really a text for thinking about how to design space. Mm-hmm. And obviously, is for those that saw the film, it's not a video game. There's no explicit levels. I got really into this idea of a dungeon that sort of generates itself. And so in video games, there's this idea of like an infinite dungeon, like a generative dungeon. So mm-hmm. these structures that every time you die, when you come back to it, there's a certain qualities to it that are similar. There'll be similar beasts. There'll be similar kind of the walls will be made out of the same pixel rocks, but they're completely different. They're like these living organisms. Mm-hmm. And so that became interesting. And it was really just about kind of following that and trying to be in this environment with honesty, with these people having conversations. I mean, it in a way, it's somewhat apocryphal to mm-hmm. claim I'm always working in isolation because I try really hard to surround myself with talented people.
I kind of wanted to know why, like, the little Mario character didn't jump out and start elevating on these levels.
I just haven't gotten there yet.
When you're in this space and you have 4 screens and 7 speakers, are you animating and creating in that space? Or because when I'm watching this film projected, I'm imagining you in front of like a laptop or an iMac, and you're just like, you know, pixel pushing around these things and, you know, putting code in for the procedural animation and things like that. But then, I mean, is that what you're doing, or is it bigger than that? You're projecting it so that you're not just thinking of it in this small space.
Well, I mean, there's a few different things. When like a laptop screen is very different than a projected image.
Yes.
There's different technology. Mm-hmm. There's different physical qualities to that. Projected light hitting a screen mm-hmm. has completely different qualities. And especially with most projected images, the projector has been somewhat distorted. So mm. it's there's a specific resolution that the projector outputs, but by the time it hits the screen, that's been changed. And so there's a value in thinking about, okay, when I'm presenting something that's going to be projected onto a screen, what is that actually going to look like? And so working with like really simple black and white, I mean, some of you may have experienced this in the film, you'll see colors, and those colors will be different depending on what kind of technology is projecting that black and white, because there's different, classically, a red, green, blue light will merge to create white light. When it's not there, there's no red, green, blue, and that's black light. But those things are have different rates of being refreshed, and so you can start to be sensitive to that. And so one of the big functions of actually building the space or having the material, the technology that the work is going to exist on, is to just know what it actually is that you're actually working with. And so a lot of the time when I was working in that space, I would have material up, but I would still be working on my computer. It wasn't like I'm using those as my screens. That would have been masochistic.
Because I remember reading in Walter Murch's book, In the Blink of an Eye, which is kind of the book that they make every training video editor to read. He would describe his process of going from a small screen, editing on a small screen, to imagining what it would be like projected on like a giant screen, because your eye moves differently across a computer monitor versus a giant film screen. And so he would put a little G.I. Joe character in front of his computer so that he could cognitively make that leap down into this person and imagine what he's seeing. And I always thought that was fascinating. So that's what I envisioned you doing when you're designing, you know, pattern language, thinking about how this is going to project itself forward and thinking of the audience.
What feels tricky about, so like making work where I'm often like building my own bespoke movie theater every time I'm presenting it, like I have to think about the scalable nature of this work. And so unlike making something that is in an industrial format. So thinking about I'm editing Apocalypse Now, it's like, well, that's a 70 millimeter film. Maybe it'll get boiled down to 35, but it's, and then maybe it'll get put on VHS, but there's still these formats and it's pretty countable what those formats are. I don't work that way. I consider those formats and at some point I often try to strive for those formats, but there's a multitude of different possibilities. And so that scalability forces me to just conceive of what the work is really differently.
And that's interesting too, because, you know, we think about the limits of a format that, I mean, when I started doing film production, video production, it was standard definition. And so we have things like, you know, 640 by 480. And I mean, that's very small.
That's
and now
school.
We have like, you know, 1080p, 4K, 8K in Japan. But yet with programming, you don't have to worry about that. I mean, it's like vector graphics in a way, where you could almost change the nature of an image programmatically.
There's a way in which I don't have to worry. I could let my computer do all the work for me. There's a way in which, like, yeah, I don't have to worry about that. But I often think, I mean, it's interesting because I make interactive installations, I make generative artwork, and I don't really like interactive installations or generative artwork. And that's like a really broad blanket statement. But part of that is I really value when something is felt considered. Yeah. When I watch a film and I feel a cinematographer's care and consideration for the framing. And I feel a similar kind of partnership with generative technology, with computer technology, that like maybe I'm controlling in a way, but I do actually really care about cultivating a specific kind of design, a specific framework, a specific image. And if these sort of functions that I'm working with, these systems that I'm working with aren't getting me there, then I put even more constraints on them to get them to where it's feeling appropriate.
One of the things that's interesting is we take this idea of an individual artist and the medium in which you're working in. Now we move to Ivar, where you're curating public space and you're curating animation for a public space. So how does that change how you think about the canvas, you know, because now you're not maybe considering, you know, the medium in which it's presented. Now you're, in terms of like an iPhone or a TV, now you're like thinking much broader.
I think the early stages of the development of my work outdoor on LED were critical to this leap from traditional film and video art and saying, A, there's a plethora of it out there. There's so much that you can put on a screen. And most people, if they go into a bar, they're going to see sports on a screen or a news channel. There's very little interest in those things. And there's a great interest in video art for me, but one of the first steps that I took with public LED was looking at the technology and saying, it shouldn't just be for live action, or there's mm-hmm. things that to me don't work when they're stuck on the side of a building, they're in the context of an urban environment, they're on this technology that seems to enhance the quality of a certain type of film. And then also because it's public, you know, you could show a movie on a public screen mm-hmm. and maybe expect people to sit there for an hour and a half or 2 hours or whatever to absorb it. But in my mind from the get-go, it was, you know, it's sort of a passive experience mm-hmm. At the start. You want to put something really mind-blowing out there to grab people's attention, but really it can operate in a few different ways, and sort of distilling it down over time to a point where I'm working with various genres, various durations. Mm-hmm. The whole system started with just being able to do 15 second works. And to me, that was limiting mm-hmm. and saying, I want to allow the artist's creation to not be limited by the factors that go along with this project. There's a really hard barrier to get through. Mm-hmm. It took quite a few years, but once you got there, it's really about a lot of factors of what makes sense. And also one of the primary factors in working in public is you can't freak out the public too bad. I mean, you know, that's to this day I go, in the hands of anybody else, the project could look totally different because most people want silly things or things that don't challenge them, or challenge them in a different way that's very accessible to all. And I've always felt my role as a curator, and particularly in a contemporary art gallery context, is if I'm not pushing the envelope a little bit, what's the value of even doing it?
Yeah.
So even within the public realm, there's got to be an understanding of the lines that you can bump up to and what you don't want to cross. Peter's work is a great example of that. It's not necessarily acceptable to put some of his other works onto a public screen. I can't remember, is Black and White, is that the name of it? One of the
Green Red.
Yeah. I mean, there's, you know, the warning that was put up yesterday before the screening. I don't like to have to worry about that kind of warning, and I've shown many works that certainly have that. But even the context of public LED usually isn't going to have the same effect that might in an indoor context or even on a small screen. So there's just a lot of things to think about. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you can break the rules. Sometimes you have to really know what the rules are that you don't want to break.
Well, and I imagine too, for both of you, animation in a certain context, I mean, when we say animation, most people think Disney, Pixar, kind of that commercialized sense of animation. How does your work really start to change that conception of animation?
Yeah, well, that's a really good question. And I'd love to hear what Peter has to say about this too. But for me, calling it animation has been the toughest thing. Yeah. I would say my sensibilities within Supernova and starting with Denver Digerati, where this is motion-based art by contemporary artists. Mm. If you try to have a public program and say motion-based work by contemporary artists, nobody's going to show up. Maybe it doesn't matter, but how you define things is really important. And as I started mining deeper and deeper and saying, well, you know, we can have a program based on this one night and put that out to the public. Maybe we don't want to do the same genre the next time. We have to explore the boundaries. And in exploring the boundaries, and to this day, I still struggle with the term digital animation and calling the festival a digital animation festival. Mm-hmm. But it's too clunky to change it to digital animation and motion art. Or you could just say digital motion art, which I think maybe is more appropriate, but I also don't feel that's quite right. Mm-hmm. So
just call it digital art. I mean, like, and I suppose to address your question in regards to like thinking about the context of Pixar or Disney, mm-hmm. like that's not my context. And so in regards to like trying to change the conception of what animation is, I'm actually, that sounds like a lot of hard work.
Yeah,
you know,
it
and
does.
And what's the value of doing that hard work? Like Disney and Pixar are serving a function and a role, and they have massive amount of resources that I don't have. And that's great. That's fine. I mean, any discipline, any form has boundary conditions, and I enjoy hanging out in boundary conditions.
I appreciate you saying that too, because I think for a lot of people who create things, sometimes we look at those big examples of what the boundary looks like or what the examples are. So for podcasting, for example, we look at things like, you know, maybe Joe Rogan or Malcolm Gladwell or, you know, these big giant names and examples, and then automatically disqualify ourselves because we don't look like that. So I appreciate you saying, you know, I try to find my own way forward with my own expression.
Yeah, Malcolm Gladwell and Joe Rogan are way less interesting than, I mean, I don't listen, but I listen to like dorky rock climbing and video game podcasts. I mean, I'm not even going to say what, but like... It's just about getting, like, because of the plethora of this material and this medium, I can get hyper specific and indulge that. Mm-hmm. And I love that.
Right. And that's a function, I think, just of time and technology progressing as well, because, you know, it was harder to be a recognized outcast in the early days of the internet because you could be an outcast, but no one knew you. Whereas now you can kind of be a recluse, but a known recluse, and be admired by an audience now. It's a weird dynamic.
The internet is mainstream now. It's official.
I'm flashing back to that moment in Hackers where, you know, you have these kind of early 2000s animation styles.
We're in the Matrix.
Yeah.
Welcome, everyone.
Welcome, yes. So with this speeding notion of technology where we are just, I mean, about 3,000 trends just passed us by in this minute, you know, how do you stay current? How do you keep your pulse on what you're doing and how it fits into culture and how the space is moving around us?
I don't think I'm the right person to answer whether I'm staying current. Mm-hmm. For me, it feels more interesting to challenge myself to stay curious and to stay active, but whether that aligns with any popularity of styles, it feels really, as an artist, as someone who's producing work that is aimed at being meaningful to me or feeling honest, that feels very dangerous to be concerned with what other people's sense of style is.
And that's the perfect answer coming from an artist, because I always say it's really tough to be an artist. If you think about what the market should want or where the direction should take you, then you're not really being genuine with your work. And I do think you have to be curious about where tools can take you and where your brain takes you. Now, from my perspective, and this is maybe just a little bit more interesting from, you know, a cultural standpoint, and saying when I started within the deep dive into digital animation, it didn't seem like there were too many wow factors, you know, too many wow artists. There certainly were a few, and, you know, Peter opened my eyes up to some of them, including himself, but it took a few years for him to get to this point where I'm saying, wow, that just seems, you know, light years beyond anything else. But for the one or two or handful of artists that are like that, most of the work that you're seeing doesn't seem that complex or boundary breaking. And over the last few years, what's really intrigued me is seeing these, you know, pretty big steps in technique and in the evolution, and seeing where that's coming from. And you know, just having this realization that animation started as artists drawing on paper or whatever medium, and it's this just incredibly tedious thing that you can use paint, you can use pen, you can use whatever. But today, you know, computer technology, programs, there's so many ways that you can start to infiltrate into animation, and seeing that really start to stack up, from my perspective, is very fascinating. And it's exciting to see that and go, that growth level is very rapid. You're starting to see it with really young artists. And at the same time, you're always going to be looking at things for what they represent and what they really mean. So a great example, Jaron Braxton, who Peter knows, he's a really great, you know, up-and-coming animator. He was one of the award winners at Supernova 2 years ago. We brought him out for education forum and to be a guest juror just a month ago at Supernova. And he opened my eyes just massively during his artist talk, because nobody's looking at his work and looking for the reference points to the history of animation. And when he divulged those, I was like, oh my God, this guy's, his work has way more depth than I think what people maybe associate with it or would ever get. And that's something that I loved was, you know, he's thinking about where this work can be applied and how it's going to fit in with culture today. But he's really riffing on the way any good artist is, would be, you know, understanding the precursors, the history, what that means. Just the reverence for animation as an art form was all over his presentation. And I thought, that's great.
Yeah. I really love that idea and riffing on things too, because in one sense, when we think about the speed of the world, we and how it relates to things like mastery, where to be, you know, a master animator or a master of your craft, where you're known for having quality and having been really good. But when we have a social media sense where we just need to get stuff out immediately, where we need to be current, we need to be like not current in terms of a trend, but just current of the moment. And I like this idea that we can have depth, we can have influences, we can have mastery, and we can do that over a period of time, but also reveal it today.
Yeah. Well, having worked with artists for over 20 years now, it's not until 20 years later that you really understand the relevance. It's not until 30 years later, 50 years later. I mean, no artist should be considered credible in their first year, the first 5 years, their first 10 years, their first 20 years. I mean, that, you know, like I do think that visual artists in particular are treated differently from other mediums, artistic mediums like, you know, music and film. It's career should be about your life and how that unfolds over time.
One of the ways that if a career is about what's going on in your life, Peter, you have gone through a massive change right now where you are in, what is it, the first month and a half of a new career in teaching. And it's probably too early to ask this question, but how has going in front of a classroom and mingling within the students and interacting and caring for them impacted your art?
Well, in a way, it doesn't feel that different than what my life was before. I have a salary. I have resources. That feels really different. So that's cool.
Nice.
So yeah, I guess that's cool.
Yeah.
Because before, what it was like I had a sort of provisional communities scattered around the world. Occasionally, I would give workshops or give lectures. It's still teaching, right? It's still, you know, there's pedagogy there. It's still kind of talking about craft.
$10 word.
There it is. Yeah, sorry. And so, yeah, so I'm in a sort of a formalized version of that, but my it's a temporary position, and my title is visiting artist. And so actually nothing has changed except now I'm visiting.
But in a way, though, I mean, there's a sense, I taught for 7 years before taking an extended break. And in that 7 years, I realized that I had transformed as a creative. I had transformed through the expression of what I do to other people. And I can't wait to see how you transform in the process of even being a visiting artist.
Yeah, well, I mean, I feel a great sense of responsibility now, right? Like, I feel like that's what I've taken on, is to take on a sense of responsibility that extends beyond a personal logic and to take on others' struggles and senses of their practice and their world explicitly. But that feels like just what the doctor ordered right now. I mean, 2019, let's all practice that.
You know, Peter has a great opportunity, whether it's limited as a visiting artist or whether he continues to influence other artists. Certainly that's common when it comes to, you know, university level education. And one of my happiest moments this year was when Fayez Jaffrey picked up a class. I think it might have been his first teaching gig in New York at Parsons. And he contacted me out of the blue earlier this year and said, can I send you my student shorts from this year? Take a look. And I'm like, sure, let's check them out. Hmm. And I looked at these works and I my eyes lit up and I was like, oh my gosh, I'd really like to show these at Supernova. You can tell, you know, like,
cool.
Like the quality, it was like something that you hadn't seen before. Mm-hmm. Student works coming directly from the authority of the professor and the guidance. Mm-hmm. It's not like they were mini versions of Fayez. They just had his stamp of direction and maybe what to think about using technique. And to me, that was just one of the most awesome things. Mm-hmm. In fact, we gave a student award this year, and I didn't determine it. It went to one of his students from that program. I've always regretted seeing artists having too much influence over their students, mm-hmm. in what they're doing, but more about how they're thinking about what they're doing,
right.
And what that can lead to. Because I think that's really what makes the world progress. There should be more excellent artists teaching, mm-hmm. and not just those that couldn't figure out something else to do.
Right. Well, and I think there's you mentioned too, where you could see some of the teachers that had stopped caring. And that's a very real concern when you're teaching, is that you have to have that gauge of like, do I still feel the weight of responsibility? Do I still care? And the minute you say no, you have a choice to make. You either stay or go. And I think that has as much of an impact on a student as, you know, the craft and the artistic and the empowering power that you have.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, comfort is intoxicating, right? And it's hard to force ourselves, mm-hmm. to be pushing for that extra energy to care.
Yeah.
Fortunately, it's coming naturally to me right now. So the real challenge is going to be in 30 years.
Well, this has been a fantastic conversation. I have a couple more questions. We're kind of running up at the time. But the first question that I have is, I've been thinking about this a lot since you mentioned it. You mentioned it a couple of times. You mentioned it yesterday. You mentioned it in the panel this morning on optimism. But you said that you think of the world as a utopia.
I think of myself as a utopian.
Oh, okay. A utopian.
Yeah.
And I was curious about that, because what does the world look like to a utopian?
Well, I guess it just means that I feel comfortable having ideals and projecting those ideals out into the world. And mm-hmm. I'm very suspicious of anybody telling me something is realistic, mm-hmm. when it isn't in the past. Mm.
How would you describe your worldview, Ivar? Would you call yourself a utopian?
I've never sat and thought, am I a utopian or not? I'm usually stubborn in my ideals and the way I see the world. And I don't necessarily like to play along with what, you know, normal connotations are. And so for me, there's a resistance to what might seem like normal practices, and that's for better or worse. So in a way, that might be, you know, the desire for a utopian life. I mean, it's not easy, because I would say being involved in the arts and in creative professions most of my life, it's not like you're surrounding yourself by people in society that get you, mm-hmm. and really accept your vision and what you're doing. You have to build towards that. And even with a solid infrastructure, there's not a day that goes by where I have no idea if I'm on the right track or, you know, doing the right thing. Mm. So there's validation points along the way. And I feel positive that I am living in a utopian dream of my own making. But it's a tough fight sometimes. To
do you have a refined compass, at least, to know if you're headed in the right direction, or do you just kind of take it? You know,
I don't know. I've always felt personally that I'm a very visual person and intuitive. Mm. That I just think has gotten me a long way. It's the intuition that probably dominates, and just, you know, understanding things visually is who I am.
Awesome. Well, last question for you before we take a couple of questions from the lovely audience. What's one book or podcast that has blown your mind recently? I ask this of everyone. I'm building my library.
Well, I... I do not listen to podcasts that often.
Shame. I don't either. And I make one.
Yeah. I'm an avid reader. I love reading. And I've read so many books that blow my mind. But there is an author who I discovered this year, Otessa Moshfa. She popped up in a New Yorker article. And I read her latest book and got totally obsessed. And so I've read all of her work, but recently I kind of took a backwards approach, because if you find a good author, and it's usually not with their first work that you're hearing about them. So I just started going back, and her first book, Magloo, is a very short, brief read, but it's, a revelation that somebody could have that as a first novel. And if you want to check out her work and you like fiction that's just so well constructed, and particularly for maybe people with artistic creative minds, you can't do much better than that.
Cool. How about you, Peter?
I've been thinking about Ivar talking about idealism and whether or not you have a compass or what it is to exist in the world with ideals, and thinking about your previous question. A book that within the past few years has blown my mind is a book that was, I think it was published in 1969, called Arcology, City in the Image of Man, by an architect named Paolo Soleri. And I bring it up because essentially it's a bunch of work that he was doing in the 60s designing potential architectural models for high-density living. Soleri conjured this term arcology, which is a portmanteau of architecture and ecology. So he's conceiving of buildings performing an environmental function, it coexisting with their environment, which, coming from a modernist training at the time, was kind of a radical idea. Worked with Frank Lloyd Wright and the such. But innovated in very imaginary science fiction conceptual ways, conceived of these potential structures for high density living, kind of conceiving of buildings as bodies. His writing is wild. His drawings are incredible. And he actually started building one of these arcologies in the Arizona desert in the 70s called Arcosanti. I was there couple of years ago. You can get an Airbnb there. Soleri,
of course you can.
Yeah. No, I mean, there's a few different ways, but you can rent room there. Soleri is unfortunately no longer living, but this structure that he started building is still, it's still alive. And one thing that's interesting about spending a week there is that it's a space that is only 4% finished. It's, in a way, it's a sort of utopian model. It's called an urban laboratory. When you drive up, there's a sign that says it's an urban laboratory. And there hasn't been a construction project since the 90s, since the early 90s. Like, it's been in this state of 4% completion, a 4% utopia for decades. And I think that that's a really great model for thinking about how to keep this kind of idealism in a constant state of becoming, of like, can we build a thing that is never going to be finished?
Yeah. Wow. I have no response to that. And usually I have a good response.
Question time.
Mind blown.
Been a proponent of this for a while, because I seem to recall this context, but I'm like, was that coming from Peter or somebody else?
Yeah, Soleri is a really interesting thinker and doer, and had some really interesting and outrageous ideas. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much to you both for sharing and being willing participants to do a live interview. This has been pretty awesome. Does
no
anyone
heckling from the audience.
No heckling. It's great. Does anyone have any questions? Feel free to ask any questions of Peter or Ivar, and I'll repeat the question just so that we have it. So, bringing play into your creative process to make it stronger.
So many things that came up today make me realize, like, man, the world is stressful. This idea that we're on this like 24-hour work cycle, if we care about social media, which we're supposed to. And this idea of taking our careers seriously as artists or organizers or podcasters or whatever it is, there's something that's really serious about these notions. Money is immediately makes me feel really serious. And it becomes, in regards to like kind of unclogging these creative channels, when I feel stressed or when I feel really serious about something, that can be a really great place for motivation. I'm so motivated when I'm freaked out. I can work for a long time when I'm freaked out, but maybe that's not a really creative time. I suppose I try to, like in my art practice, I try to have a habit of working in these ways where it can be directionless, or that a project can be open-ended enough that I can explore things that maybe don't make sense. Fortunately, with my work, it's not ever meant to serve a functional role. And so inherently there's like a lot of invitation to play, but it still gets scary. I mean, I'm constantly freaked out about being a failure, and you know, I feel like I'm constantly on the brink of feeling like a god that creates worlds and it has so powerful and it's awesome, and then immediately we'll just realize like, man, when this world really goes to hell, I have no skills, I'm gonna die super fast. And it's like, it's that oscillation that is, I mean I don't really know what to do with that, but I think that there's a way that like being playful with that sense can allow me to entertain both notions and on a good day create work from it.
I'm entirely not certain how to answer this, because it's hard for me to think of like play in the context of the creativity. And I of course, not being an artist, I'm always playing around with new things or new ideas or just trying to look at things in a new way. And I rarely try to have a template for what I'm doing and, you know, say, oh, well, that worked, so let's just keep doing that. Mm-hmm. For me, there's just an associative angle of trying to keep my brain open through other mediums. I'm not the type of person that wants to sit there for 10 hours and work on a project. I'm the type of person that wants to take a bath in the morning. I get my best ideas while I'm in the bathtub. No shit. I mean, I have my phone there and I write them in my notes, because that's when the ideas come. And if I don't get them down, they may just dissipate. And then you go to your desk, you work for a little bit. I usually need to just break up the process a little bit. And there might be some play involved in that. I would say, I know the last couple of years I've made comments to some people that I don't admire adults that much, particularly right now in what's happening in the world. And I go, it's much better to kind of associate with how youth maybe operates, and that it's a good thing, can be a good thing, because that's where creativity really, you know, bubbles up the most.
One of the ways that I try to bring play into the process, when you're creating a weekly show, so you have a template, you have kind of a structure, and you kind of get used to that structure over time, and it can be hard to play within the confines of that structure. And so I'm laughing right now because I hear a lawnmower, and a lawnmower is an ongoing joke in my show because my neighbor mows his lawn every time I hit record. And so sometimes when, in that sense of play, you're just like, I just start calling it out now. I'm like, there's that frickin' lawnmower again. Thanks, buddy. This episode brought to you by John Deere. You know, so
do people think now that you're like triggering the guy next door, like,
maybe
put the lawnmower on?
Yeah,
so
I don't know, but sometimes the sense of play is like, I worry sometimes that you hear that stuff. Or one time I had a plane fly over, and my friend called me. He's like, dude, I thought that was my house. You know, just it's. But I find that's the playful things that make it real, that keep people engaged, that takes the obsession away, that makes it not fun anymore. And so sometimes I'll sing just weirdly at the end of the show, and I'll cut it out, or I'll leave it in. It just depends on whether I've gotten enough sleep or not, or I'll hum and do weird little things like that. But I get self-conscious about it a lot. And so play is kind of hard in a structured, confined. But then in like video, I do a lot of video production as well, and like I get so serious. Like someone took a picture of me one time and I had this scowl on my face, but I'm having a great time. And so play is one of those things where I just have to like think about it. Like I'm playing right now. It's actually a lot of fun. I might not look like it though. I might look like I'm miserable or something. So I love that question a lot. Endlessly mutating labyrinth.
Yeah, thank you for that question. How long should I talk for?
We have 15 minutes.
Okay. I should talk about catharsis. There's a way that I think about art practice for me serving a cathartic role, which is like on a really personal level, having a creative practice can potentially be a way to help digest emotions that otherwise are not being digested. There was a long period of my life where I was in a a really dark space, really heavy. I don't want to pathologize it because I had a really difficult time engaging with the mental health industry, psychology, therapy. It just, these different systems weren't functioning in a way that I had hoped that they would function. And so my art practice served a really significant role in helping me digest things that were happening in my life. And my brain, like having logic, being able to apply these scalpels, these tools, these weapons of logic that we learn in school or otherwise just as human beings who are no different than barbarians that existed thousands of years ago, really. So how do we apply that to ourselves in constructive ways? At the time, I was thinking a lot about visual metaphor. There was a period of time where I was doing occasionally illustration work. I'd done a couple of illustrations for the New York Times, and it was really cool. And that platform was a really interesting platform. I was working with a great artistic director there. And it got me thinking about visual metaphor in a lot of different ways. And so I started thinking about ways to represent these feelings that I was feeling in ways that were iconographic. And so that led me to thinking about labyrinths and thinking about prehistoric depictions of labyrinths. I think about Debbie Millman's presentation yesterday about brands. Mm-hmm. I had an interesting conversation with her about, like, is there a way that a labyrinth, you know, because there are some really classic prehistoric labyrinths that are iconic in their way. And so I started looking at that, doing research on that, and allowing this icon to become something that I explored in diverse ways and allowed it to be a bit of a barometer. And so there's this cathartic role by creating an emblem or a banner that was really personal and served this role that was very personal for me, could inform all these different things. And so it was a compass, and it led me towards thinking about, I mean, now making video games, right? And in a way of thinking about multicursal narratives. Video games are not films. There are video games that are filmy and there are films that are video gamey, but
filmy.
One of the interesting things about interactive art is it requires our touch to live, right? It requires participation, and a good game, I would argue, is constructed in such a way that your play or your action, the way that you're actioning that environment, creates a unique path, creates unique narratives. There are these ideas of like emergent narrative. A really great game that I love is called Dwarf Fortress. It's if anybody has problems sleeping, put on Dwarf Fortress on YouTube. It's like such a snooze fest. It's like all ASCII art, and it's the simulation of a world where you're a fortress manager and you have these seven dwarves and you try to just manage the dwarf's fortress. And it's incredible. And there's an amazing text engine in there. So like occasionally you can kind of tune out of this ASCII matrix universe, and there are these written lore, right? There's a written canon that's being developed, and the way that it's written is so beautiful. These wild narratives are being constructed that are also kind of nonsense, but that sort of like multicursal potential, it feels a lot more aligned with the way that I experience the present and the future than any film. To get back to the labyrinth as an icon or as a concept, it just became something that was really fertile to explore, and I'm just not done with it yet.
I would be a bad host if I didn't recommend David Bowie's performance in Labyrinth.
Oh man, I hate that film aged so badly.
It did. Yeah, it really did. Yeah. All right. Well, thank you so much for coming. It was an awesome experience from my perspective to do a live interview with Peter and Ivar.
Thank you so much. Thank you
for providing awesome questions. One note I do want to make, if you are thinking of ever doing a podcast, don't feel that you need to listen to podcasts to do it. Don't let that disqualify you. The cost of entry is insanely low if you have a smartphone or anything that records audio. Just get it close to your mouth and start talking. That's all you really need. You don't need to edit it. That only ups the obsession and the neurotic nature that is audio editing. And just do it. Just if you don't feel like you have something to talk about, you have something to talk about. Everyone has something to talk about, so just feel like just hit record and see what happens. So thank you so much for coming. It was an absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks, everybody. And I can't imagine leaving without you singing. Isn't this where you're supposed to sing?
You don't want to hear me sing.
Okay. Peter, you want to sing?
I'm good.
No, okay.
I'm picturing you in the bathtub now. So.
thank you so much to the team at Bend Design who brought Getting Work to Work to their annual conference. It was an intoxicating experience to talk with Peter and Ivar in front of a live audience. It definitely brings a different experience and vibe to the production of a weekly show. Be sure to follow Bend Design for recaps from all of the amazing speakers and attendees and get updates on next year's event. It's definitely a conference that's welcoming to all, and I encourage everyone to check them out next year. Until next time, may creativity and curiosity fuel your life.